Hey, it's Molly Webster. I have a surprise for you. Next month, myself and producer Mona Medgaukar are going to do an AMA about our snail sex tape episode. You can ask us anything about snails and the behind the scenes of making an episode work. How long did it take us to make? How did we come up with the sound effects? Why are snails and slugs related? The AMA will be on April 16th, and in order to come, you have to be a member of the lab. So go to radiolab.org/join right now, sign up, use the code word snail to get a discount on your membership. And also, if you sign up now, you get a snail enamel pin. If you're already a member of the lab, come to the AMA. Thank you for listening. Can't wait to see you there, April 16th.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. So, Robert, one of my favorite sounds of all time is the sound of hearing people think. You know, of hearing a mind kind of formulate a thought that wasn't there until it
clicks in.
Yeah, and that's just a beautiful sound, especially when the mind that you're listening to is a person who has shaped you, has shaped the show.
Sure.
So today, a little bit of a departure. A couple of months ago, I got connected to a guy named Bill Hayes, a mutual friend, sort of put us in touch.
He wrote a really good book, actually, about anatomy. Really good. I gave it to my son.
Really?
Yeah.
He is a writer and a photographer.
And I was the partner of the late Oliver Sacks. And together we made tapes or recordings of conversations in the last year of his life.
Now, Oliver Sacks, one of the great, great writers of science.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah. Masterful, masterful writer.
You know, we here at Radiolab have grown up with him. And his style of combining sort of clinical scientific observation with deep humanity and poetry. I feel like we're always trying to walk in his footsteps in some way.
Mm-hmm. We do.
And certainly we know we've had him on the show many, many, many times, so his voice will be familiar to a lot of you. But what you hear on these tapes is an altogether different portrait. And why? Why did you start these recordings?
Well, Oliver got his diagnosis of a terminal cancer in mid-January 2015.
He had cancer about 9 years earlier, dealt with it, but it was back and spreading through his body.
The prognosis was 6 to 18 months, and it was shattering.
Shortly after, Bill says they were sitting at the kitchen table talking.
Like, I knew that he had things on his mind that he wanted to write, and I said, well, what are you thinking about writing? This was about 4 days after he got his diagnosis, and he paused, and then he looked at me and he said, something like, a month ago, I felt that I was in good health, even robust health. At 81, I still swim a mile a day, but my luck has run out.
Hmm.
And I said, stop right there. And I grabbed a pad and a pen, and I said, start over. And I began writing as fast as I could, as he dictated virtually the entire essay.
Wow. Just sort of spilled out like that?
Yeah. And so we had the idea of getting a little audio recorder, a digital recorder, so that it could be on hand at any time, whether to record what he wanted to write or reminisce or to collect stories. After his death, I put the recorder in a drawer and didn't pull it out again until over a year and a half after his death. I didn't even listen to it, any of it, to write my own memoir. I had been kind of very nervous about listening to them because I thought it would be very sad and just that it would just make me depressed and sad. But I took the recorder out of the drawer where it had sat for 18 months and I pushed play, and of course it didn't work because the batteries were dead. So I had to scramble to find batteries, and when I did and then pushed play.
Okay, this is a recorded conversation between OWS and Billy Hayes.
I mean,
on February 6th.
The hairs on my arms went up. It was as if he was alive.
This is the first recording you made with him?
Mm-hmm. It was during dinner. We were eating at the time, and he began telling me about his dreams.
Dreams. I've been having a lot of strangely archetypal dreams of a journey I have to make.
Yeah.
Getting lost and getting found, full of surprises. There may be going through a door, which I think will be a door into another room, but it's a door into a mountain landscape.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes frightening ravines or having to edge along very narrow ledges, but then finally coming to some gracious, heavenly mountain meadow, and then waking. Dreams about journeys, an approaching end, and it's a journey from where to where.
This was February 6th, 2015, so about 3 weeks after Oliver got his diagnosis of a terminal cancer. And his immediate impulse was to write.
And yet, again, this balance has been forced into my mind by the events of the past 2 weeks.
Oliver was quite deaf. Even louder than he realized, he would whisper words to himself as he wrote them down on the pad, and he wrote with a fountain pen. For Oliver, writing was a form of thinking and the primary activity for a human being.
My normal health. Normal state of health and energy, at least such health and energy as a fit and active 81-year-old old can hope to enjoy. And this, despite having, and I know in the previous month, a liver full melanoma metastases.
Do you have new pages?
Yeah, I hear, right. Things are out. This is from there.
Out. What I'm going to do is just leave that all there so you can look at it again.
Good, yes. No, nothing must be destroyed. And I'm a creature of multiple drafts. As you know, symptoms, limbs, but was of the general feeling of disorder, which goes with them, and which may be tolerably severe. So severe. Patients may long for death. And now what happened to my other magnifying glass?
Oliver was the kind of guy who would take dictionaries to bed to read with a magnifying glass.
Can you bring my Chambers dictionary or look up a word for me?
Sure.
You may need a magnifying glass, and I have one here. Aha! I also feel the missing magnifying glass. There it is. Can you see if there's a word, resipiscence? R-E-S-I.
Yes, there is. Change to a better frame of mind. To be wise.
To be wise. Can you pull out the big dictionary and see if you can find any examples? In particular, I want to know whether a return to health.
Okay.
Here is a man with a huge vocabulary and love of writing, but still, every day he would be struck by a word that he wanted to look up.
Well, it immediately says repentance for misconduct.
What did you say?
Repentance for misconduct, recognition of errors committed, return to a better mind or opinion.
What's the origin of the word?
To recover one's senses, come to oneself again.
Yeah, come to one's senses. I think that's not quite the word I want.
Debilitating. Debilitating. Tiredness disappeared. I felt a little return of energy. Homeostasis is coming back. Coming back, my fucking body, which I had so cursed.
Here's some ginseng.
Well, thank you very much. Healing yourself. Gratitude pours forth continually. The unexpected had happened. The hope for health. The hope for health. Reawaken faith in tomorrow. Awaken faith for tomorrow. After tomorrow. Okay, Billy.
Yeah?
Shall I read something to you?
Yes.
A general feeling of disorder. It is especially when things are going wrong internally, when homeostasis is not being maintained, when the autonomic balance starts listing heavily to one side or the other, that this core consciousness, the feeling of how one is, takes on an intrusive, unpleasant quality. And now one will say, I feel ill. Something is amiss. At such times, one... Indeed, everything comes and goes, and if one could take a scan or inner photograph of the body at such times, one would see vascular beds opening and closing, peristalsis accelerating or stopping, viscera squirming or tightening in spasms, secretions suddenly increasing or decreasing, as if the nervous system itself were in a state of indecision. Instability, fluctuation, and oscillation are of the essence in the unsettled state. This feeling of disorder. We lose the normal feeling of... The procedure, though relatively benign, would lead to the death of a huge mass of melanoma cells. These, in dying, would give off a variety of unpleasant and pain-producing substances. Soon after waking from the embolization, I was to be assailed by feelings of excruciating tiredness and paroxysms of sleep so abrupt they could poleaxe me in the middle of a sentence or a mouthful. Delirium would seize me within seconds, even in the middle of handwriting. I felt extremely weak and inert. On day 10, I turned a corner. I felt awful as usual in the morning, but a completely different person in the afternoon. This was delightful and wholly unexpected. I suddenly found myself full of physical and creative energy and euphoria almost akin to hypomania. Exuberant thoughts rushed through my mind. How much of this was a re-establishment of balance in the body? How much an autonomic rebound after a profound autonomic depression? How much other physiological factors? And how much the sheer joy of writing? I do not know. But my transformed state and feeling were, I suspect, very close to what Nietzsche experienced after a period of illness and expressed so lyrically in The Gay Science. Gratitude pours forth continually, as if the unexpected had just happened. The gratitude of a convalescent, for convalescence was unexpected. The rejoicing of strength that is returning, of a reawakened faith in a tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, of a sudden sense and anticipation of a future, of impending adventures, of seas that are open again.
Where's the microphone on this bloody thing? Well, okay, you're recording this, right? The time is 9:20 in New York. It would be 5 hours difference with Greenwich Mean Time. And it is Monday the 9th. That's to say the 20th day after my embolization and just 48 hours till the next one. End of recording. Pause.
On March 11th, Oliver had the second embolization surgery, which would cut off blood supply to the tumors growing in his liver, with the idea that it would give Oliver more time, more energy.
Question.
We'd been together 6 years. I knew him well, and yet I'd never seen him with such focus.
Billy finds my question.
Just constantly writing.
I don't know what to call this piece. They can title it. Ninth Avenue and the Glorious Forest.
No, well, I like the future I shall never know.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's it. I think I need to put in, otherwise, just to indicate why I should...
Have some insurance.
And I say to Billy, who is a good deal younger, who is a good deal younger than I am, originally I put who was two-thirds my age, so I have to be precise.
I like that.
Okay.
I mean, that is really precise.
Okay, who is exactly two-thirds my age. Okay, so that's that. A little piece...
For the New Yorker.
Yes.
Okay, have some insurance and I'll heat your suit.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I like the idea of saying Billy, who is exactly two-thirds of my age. It's not a fraction you expect to see. Three-quarters, yes. Half, yes. But not two-thirds. I like the idea of putting a tiny arithmetical conundrum.
Ninth Avenue Reverie, published March 20th, 2015. Driving down Ninth Avenue, choking on diesel fumes from a truck just ahead of us, I say to my friend Billy, he is exactly two-thirds my age, I wonder whether you will see the end of internal combustion engines, the end of oil, a cleaner world. The thought zooms me away from Ninth Avenue to a forest world. In particular, to the one described in That Glorious Forest, Sir Gillian Prance's book about his 39 visits to the Amazon in the past 50 years. He sees what we are doing to the Amazon and its many peoples. He speaks for conservation, sanity, reason, before we destroy it all. I went to That Glorious Forest in 1996, 11 days of botany, study, and hiking, seeing hundreds of different species of trees in a single acre. I had planned, before I became ill, to go to Madagascar to see its forests and its unique fauna and other wildlife, especially the lemurs. I love lemurs. One has to see them, study them, to grasp the origin of our primate nature. But most of the forests on Madagascar have already been obliterated, and, not unnaturally, the lemurs are dying. Honking horns bring me back to Ninth Avenue. I seem to have spent hours lost in reverie, thinking about the Amazonian and Madagascan forests, lemurs, the time machine. But we have scarcely moved, are still behind the stinking, lung-destroying truck. Not in my life, Billy answers.
I've been reading a lot of it aloud to Billy.
This is a recording where Oliver is talking on the phone to Lawrence Weschler, or Ren Weschler.
But anyhow, I was due to have a CAT scan follow-up on Thursday. I was terrified of this. In fact, what it did show was that 80% of the metastases in the liver had been destroyed by the embolization. With luck, I should have two or three good months after this. I just hope that I can see friends and write and maybe travel a little. And I think next month, if I'm up to it, I'm going to go to London to say hello and possibly farewell to friends and family. And I can't think ahead beyond that. Six, seven, it's still one short. Semantics. Semantics. Content. Betting these. Betting these.
use of elementary units. Phonemes and its inseparability. Intimate relation.
Ooh, I want to hear, I want to hear.
Over the years, I filled upwards of 1,000 notebooks. Their contents are very various, but three of them have had a special function: to record abnormalities of perception during times of sensory impairment or deprivation. The current notebook is a very modest affair. It is quite small and slips easily into a pocket. Crucial, because I need to have it with me at all times. With increasing deafness, I am more and more prone to mishearing what people say. But mishearings deceive one entirely. You accept what you hear. You accept what you see. Every mishearing is a novel, surprising concoction. One never gets used to them. The 100th is as fresh, as absurd, and as thought-provoking as the first. Mishearing became a mishearing. Take the car for a spin became take the car for a swim. I've noted that. Your harness became your highness. Therapist invertebrate.
Tarot cards, pteropods.
Big time publisher was heard as a big time cuttlefish.
I said, did you say a poetry bag? And you said, no, I said a grocery bag.
I love the idea of a poetry bag.
Yes. I'm inclined almost to put them all in.
I think they should all be in.
Yeah. I mean, the sheer mass will make the point.
Mm-hmm.
That sound trumps everything.
One's surroundings, one's wishes and expectations, conscious and unconscious, can certainly be co-determinants in mishearing. But the real mischief lies at lower levels, in those parts of the brain involved in phonological analysis and decoding, doing what they can with distorted or deficient signals from our ears. These parts of the brain manage to construct real words or phrases, even if they are absurd. And yet, there's often a sort of style or wit, a dash in these instantaneous inventions. They reflect, to some extent, one's own interests and experiences, and I rather enjoy them. Only in the realm of mishearing, at least my mishearings, can a biography of Cancer become a biography of Cantor, one of my favorite mathematicians. Tarot cards can turn into pteropods, a grocery bag into a poetry bag, all or noneness into oral numbness. And a mere mention of Christmas Eve, a command to kiss my feet.
Oops, no wonder I couldn't write anymore. I must get more cartridges. I'm going through these too quickly.
I want to reassure you, yes. All of these thoughts are already in the draft.
Oh, are they? Good.
Okay? So I think it's time to let your weary mind rest.
Yes. Okay. We'll see each other in the morning.
Okay.
If you could just kiss me whenever I had a dry mouth, I'd be in heaven.
Do you want some more water?
Yes, I better raise my head a little.
Hello, this is David from Berlin. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Guys, it's tax season. Are you as stoked as I am? No, of course you aren't. Because taxes can be super stressful. I know that I'm going to owe money, and so I'm avoiding all the emails from my accountant. I'm not alone. 88% of Americans reported financial stress at the start of 2026. So it's normal, but it doesn't mean you have to white-knuckle your way through. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. BetterHelp makes it easy, it says, by matching you with one of their over 30,000 licensed professionals tailored to your needs. And if it's not a perfect fit, you can switch at any time. And look, a therapist can't fix your money problems, but they can help you address shame, guilt, avoidance. Get matched with a qualified professional on BetterHelp. You can sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/radiolab. That's betterhelp.com/radiolab.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
Would you like to pour out some wine for your elderly lover?
Sure. You want some of this?
Yes.
Okay. You look very happy. Which one of these jackets appeals to you? If you're going to pick one, let's go to the start.
Yeah, well, of course, I have to take my own unfortunate shape.
No. I want you to respond to them. Which one? Yes.
I see.
Do you like
I'm
this?
I'm not, as fond of this sort of routine jacket with its pockets and its flaps. Functional, though it is. I don't know where I got that jacket.
It's so hot, Oliver.
Sorry?
It's so hot.
Hot.
Hot. Do you know that word? Sexy.
Yes. Yes, right.
You're very handsome.
You haven't had anything to eat.
Mm-mm.
You should have something to eat.
I might go out. I sort of enjoy that on Sunday night.
Yes, I know.
I get a little stoned and I go out into the neighborhood. Do you mind?
No. I don't know that I'm good for much company anyhow at the moment. Yeah, go rejoice. I wasn't counting. How many did you hear?
I didn't count either.
Oliver had enjoyed a couple of really good months of feeling well and fit and getting lots of writing done. He had completed not only A General Feeling of Disorder, the short piece Mishearings, his autobiography On the Move was published. He worked on a piece on the evolution of the eye, and he'd completed a major case history on the performer Spalding Gray. We'd made this wonderful trip to London for 10 days. After we returned from the trip, he knew that he would have to get another CAT scan to see how things were going. And I would say that we kind of had a feeling, an optimistic feeling. He seemed to be doing well. So he went into that hoping for the best, but it was exactly the opposite. The cancer had spread beyond the liver to other organs, that it was looking very bad indeed. Oliver, more than anyone, I think, knew that time was running out.
Billy, I wonder if I can ask you to look up something on the little box.
Sure.
The Ten Commandments. Yeah, in particular the one about keeping the seventh day holy. I'm not sure what its exact wording is.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy?
That's right. Let me just write that down. It's exactly what I want. Surgical identity.
He was having a lot of discomfort and had to have a catheter implanted in his abdomen to drain off fluid that was accumulating from the tumors, which was around August 4th or 5th. It was really the only solution, and it was quite uncomfortable. and it had to be drained daily. And it also, unfortunately, ended his swimming. He was a great swimmer, and he loved to swim. But he didn't complain. Swimming had come to an end, so he put his head down, basically, and began working on this essay, Sabbath.
Surgical identity. I think I was doing.
I knew what you were doing. I just wanted to talk to you. Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, did I miss a dramatic reading?
It just started a little while ago.
How are you?
Weak.
His longtime assistant and editor, Kate.
What are you writing about? The Sabbath?
Yep. It was going to be quite a long piece. It's going to fill an entire pad. My mother. Why don't you get a chair? I don't like you looming.
I like standing because it's better for
okay, fine, stand then.
My back. Should I loom over here?
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
My mother and her 17 brothers and sisters had an Orthodox bringing up. All photographs of their father show him wearing a yarmulke. And I was told that he woke up if it fell off during the night.
Isn't that funny?
I love that.
My father, too, came from an Orthodox background. But they were very conscious of the sixth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And Shabbos, as we called it in our Bitfuck way, was entirely different from the rest of the week. When Shabbos came in, my mother would light candles, cupping their flames with her hands, and murmuring a prayer. And I gradually became more distant or indifferent, I think it just more indifferent, to Jewish life, the synagogue, the Sabbath, and the synagogue in particular. Though there was no particular point of rupture or alienation until I was 18. It was then that my father, inquiring into my sexual feelings, compelled me to admit that I liked boys. I haven't done anything, I said, it's just a feeling. But don't tell Ma, she won't be able to take it. He did tell her, and the next morning she came down with a look of horror on her face and shrieked, "You're an abomination. I wish you had never been born." The matter was never mentioned again, and in cordiality, even love, was rebuilt. But her brutal, hateful words, her curse, made me hate Judaism, all religions, in their capacity for inhuman bigotry and cruelty. And it turned me in part to a self-hating, self-accusing closet homosexual. I'd felt a little fearful visiting my Orthodox family with my lover, Billy. My mother's words still echoed in my mind, but Billy too was warmly received, and there was no hint of the terrible bigotry of 60 years earlier. This was made clear by Robert John, and he invited Billy and me to share a Friday evening with him and his family. The peace
of the Sabbath, of a stopped world, a time outside time, was palpable, infuse everything. And Billy, I think, was as conscious of this as I was. That I'd been able, for the first time in my life, to make a full and frank declaration of my sexuality. That I was finally out of the closet, facing the world openly, the blameable guilty secrets locked up inside me. And now, weak, short of breath, my once firm muscles melted away by cancer, and my thoughts increasingly not of the supernatural, which has never made sense to me, but of what is meant by living a good and worthwhile life, achieving a sense of peace within oneself. I find my thoughts drifting to the Sabbath, the day of rest, the seventh day of the week, and perhaps the seventh day of one's life, when one can feel one's work is done and one may, in good conscience, rest.
On August 14th, Sabbath was published in the New York Times. That same day, he began to dictate the table of contents for the River of Consciousness, a collection of essays which he knew would be published posthumously. It was getting his house in order.
I don't know that I'm capable of much writing, nor that I want to do any writing, but I hope I can, as it were, think aloud to you and to Kate, the recorder. Home hospice. I think that I will require an amount of care, including intravenous nursing things, beyond what you and Kate can provide or should. And this, in turn, should release you, you know, to be just my friends and comforters. Now, one last go at tempting my appetite. Can you bring me in a little bit of kedgeree?
Just to mention, there is also chicken soup.
Yes. I probably should have some liquid.
I'll just do a little of each.
Weeks later, on August 30th, 2015, Oliver Sacks died at home. In the last 7 months of his life, he wrote and published 9 pieces, and there were many, many more that he started but wasn't able to finish.
And some of the essays he wrote are now in a new collection published after he died called The River of Consciousness, and that's just out.
The readers that you heard in the story were Radiolabbers Anna McEwen, Simon Adler, and Bethel Hopte. Thanks also to Mike Pashkash for engineering help. And this piece was produced by Carla Murthy.
This is Emily calling from Houston. Radiolab was created by Jad Ebimrod and is produced by Soren Wheeler. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Maria Matisar Padilla is our managing director. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Rachel Cusick, David Gebel, Bethel Hopte, Tracy Hunt, Matt Kilty, Robert Krolwich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Arian Wack, and Molly Webster, with help from Amanda Aronchik, Shima Oliali, David Fox, Niger Fatali, Phoebe Wang, and Katie Ferguson. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.